Hey guys, and welcome to episode 136 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I had the privilege of chatting with Dr. Patrick McGrath. I had the honor of meeting Patrick at the ICDF conference recently. He is the executive director of the Foglia Family Foundation Residential Treatment Center, which treats people with OCD and also OCD and addiction combined. He's also on the scientific advisory board for the ISDF. We talk about many things, kind of why he got into therapy, and then some other highlights are we talk about OCD and addiction, why you can treat them together. Sometimes people treat them separately, but how his clinic treats them together and the good results he's seen from that. We talk about mindfulness, how it's okay to be uncomfortable in the experience and learning to live with the thoughts. His clinic runs sort of mindfulness groups each evening. We talked about virtual reality. First person I've heard talk about this. I've only seen it in scientific studies before, which I thought was fascinating. I'm not going to give anything away, but it was brilliant. Then we talk about some advice around ERP, and again he mentions the whole point of it's okay to be uncomfortable. We discuss that OCD thinks it's being helpful. Then we break down, how some people might say OCD is a bully, it's the enemy, I'm going to war against it, and other people will look at it as just this thing that's trying to help me, it's an overactive brain and I need to deal with it. And I kind of asked him what's the preference, and he very much said it's personalized. So we get into that. We talked about as you move up the ERP hierarchy, what he's noticed some people do is they think, oh, it's okay to do that compulsion I used to do just once because, I'm better now. And he talks about how that's not necessarily a great mindset. We talk a lot about how families can get involved, both of younger people and obviously adults, to support them and the benefits of that. He also gives his word of wisdom for anyone who wants to become an OCD therapist or is becoming one. I really respect his honesty here and the kind of word of wisdom and hope he gives. This episode starts a lot around OCD and addiction, then goes more around sort of ERP and then just general advice for family. So I think you're going to enjoy this one. I certainly did. And I did some fact checking after this episode. So I talk about a story where this snake sizes up this woman. I won't give anything away. But basically, apparently, that's a load of rubbish. And pythons do not size up their victims. So I got that wrong. Please forgive me. Egg on my face. But yeah, I think the analogy and metaphor stands for itself. Just know that snakes and pythons do not do that, as far as I'm aware. So without further ado, here is Patrick. On the podcast today, I'm joined by Dr. Patrick McGrath. Patrick is the Assistant Vice President of Residential Services for Amita Health Behavioral Medicine Institute. He is also the Executive Director of the Foglia Family Foundation Residential Treatment Center and the Clinical Director for the Center for Anxiety and Obsessive Compulsive Disorders. Patrick is a member of the Scientific Advisory Board and the Conference Planning Committee for the International OCD Foundation, as well as the President of OCD Midwest. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good. I thought I was going to pass out then reading that. But
I have the longest title in the world, as far as I can tell. So yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm happy to have you on. So I thought I'd get started by kind of hearing I'm always interested in why clinicians get into treating OCD. So it'd be good to hear kind of how that came about.
Sure. It was almost a mistake in some ways. I had a plan that I was going to be a college counseling center therapist and have my summers off and work with college students who wanted to figure out, what they wanted to major in and get through kind of those transitional life problems. And I applied for a postdoc and was accepted at the St. Louis Behavioral Medicine Institute and their anxiety disorder clinic, and because I was really into cognitive behavioral therapy and that's what I wanted to do. And within about a week of being at the Behavioral Medicine Institute, I had switched my entire life goals and decisions and decided I was going to treat anxiety disorders for the rest of my life and wanted to do nothing else but that. So it was really just getting to have that hands-on experience of working with anxious people and seeing that people with OCD and anxiety disorders could really get better and could get the help that they've been looking for so long that I thought, wow, this is just the greatest career possible and the most rewarding thing that I could think of doing. And it has now been 19 years of me doing that.
Well, awesome. And that was kind of seeing the benefit of, say, ERP or whatever it is, and how effective it was, and seeing those results. That was kind of the main draw for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just to have that hands-on experience. We learn a lot, of course, about OCD in our textbooks and doing some journal articles and everything, but to have actually seen the amount of work that a therapist does with a patient, and when that patient is ready and willing and puts themselves into that situation that they get better, that's what was great. And I really loved the fact that as an exposure therapist, I wasn't just sitting there and talking to people. I was actually doing things with people, because I love going out and doing exposures right with people as well too. So it really offered me the opportunity to be much more active than prescriptive, that I could be actually going outside or driving with someone or digging in the dirt or all those things. And I just found that to be really fun and exciting, and be just sitting in an office all day.
Yeah, no, I completely understand that. Yeah, it's way more experiential and involved. Okay, so obviously you've recently set up, or actually I'm not sure when it was founded, so maybe you could tell me in a second, but the Foglia Family Foundation, the residential center, where you treat kind of OCD and addiction side by side. I guess
Correct.
what was your motivation for starting that program?
Well, we've had a partial hospital program and intensive outpatient program for anxiety disorders for over 10 years at Alexian Brothers, which originally we were Alexian Brothers Behavioral Health, and now we are kind of into a larger corporation called Amita Health. So sometimes the names get confusing to people. So, but we had that partial hospital and intensive outpatient for, like I said, a decade, and we were seeing that there were times that we were sending people out to other treatment centers and they were having to learn a new language, and even if it was exposure therapy, a different style of doing it or something like that. And so we kept in the back of our minds for several years now, wouldn't it be nice that if we had the full continuum of care and we were able to treat people with these disorders all the way through all the levels of care? And that kind of led to thinking about opening the residential. But, there, of course, are some other residentials for OCD. Not many, of course, but there's a few others out there, and they've been there, and their names are well known and everything. We also, though, had noticed that in our partial hospital program, we were doing something that was a bit unique. We had discovered through some work through the OCD Foundation that unique work was that if somebody also had a substance abuse problem, we were treating them for both, and we were doing that very quickly. Whereas other places were saying you need to be sober for 30, 60, 90 days before we'll even touch your OCD. And we were saying we'd like a week or two of sobriety, and then we'll start working on your OCD. So that also then led us into the idea that, well, what if we treated both in the same place? And so it's turned out now to be a really fruitful experience for us, that for those people who have OCD who also abuse substances, we can treat them and start working on both of those things at the same time. And what we've also found is that for the people who do come here for substance abuse, very often it's the first time they've ever been asked about mental health issues or anxiety. And we have found that the parallels between a lot of anxiety issues and substance abuse issues are really huge, where there's a lot of, quick acting, what can feel good for me right now kind of things, which we see in OCD. And boy, that's what substances provide a lot too. So the safety seeking behavior aspects are very similar. Sometimes the family dynamics can be very similar too. So it's worked out to be very well to have both of them in the same place.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, now that you say it like that, it almost seems like common sense how that they can, yeah, probably trigger similar parts of the brain. Okay, so I guess my next question would be is, why is it important then to treat the two side by side, as opposed to doing the what other treatment centers do, where they make people be sober for, say, 90 days?
Well, people have died because of it. I mean, that's the most blatant way to say it. And I think you're familiar with Margaret Cezanne and Riley's wish and her son and what he went through. And so I know Margaret, and I know how her son unfortunately overdosed. And he had been at treatment centers for OCD, and he had been at treatment centers for addiction, and they were only dealing with the one problem. But the other problem was always getting in the way of that one problem. And so he got kicked out of places because of all the interference. Whereas if he was here, we would have been dealing with both of them at the same time.
No, absolutely. And as you say, especially if the drug substance misuse is it's being done to kind of self-medicate, right? So trying to say to someone, be sober for 90 days, but then OCD's flaring up again, it's a vicious cycle.
And it does seem a bit odd that we would tell that to people, but you know, I'll say this for a lot of people who are trained in the mental health side, we don't get a lot of training, unfortunately, in graduate school on the substance abuse side. So we have to kind of step outside of our own training and really kind of go out to truly get some more work and understanding about what's going on with substance abuse, because on one hand, it may sound very simple to say, well, just stop taking something, but obviously we all know that that's just a rather impossible thing to do.
Absolutely. And I guess what does treating OCD alongside addiction look like?
Well, what we're really doing is trying to figure out the best way to manage, you know, your standard kind of hierarchy and your exposure work, along with helping people come off of detox, if that's where they started in our detox unit, and learn that they can handle dealing with their emotions. I mean, many of the people who have come here have used substances as a way to kind of mask the emotions that they were experiencing. They didn't like them. Maybe they didn't like the intrusive thoughts that they were having. So they were sitting there and using as a way to kind of drown out all those thoughts that were popping in their head. So we kind of course, do exposures to those types of things, but we also then utilize our colleagues on the substance abuse side to help people deal with the fact that you are just going to have to sit with emotions, emotions that maybe you have felt to be awful and horrible and that you tried to hide right away. So again, you can see there, I think, how hand in hand these two things can absolutely go as we're exposing people to emotions, but they're also talking to them about emotions and talking to them just about other day-to-day things like how do you deal with anger and what if somebody frustrates you and what if your family pisses you off or something like that, and which is so common in substance abuse where they have all those types of things. And to me, it's a great marriage of the two things.
No, absolutely, and I can see why that would be. And do you feel it's going to change then over the next 10 years that more inpatient clinics are going to follow suit to what you
I
guys are
think
doing?
that they probably will. I think if people see that what we're doing is really working, which, you know, we're collecting our data right now to kind of show what's happening. But I think that once we're able to have a little bit more under our belt and can work on some publishing of that people will see that this is a very worthwhile effort. And but it does take a bit of a sea change in thought processes as well as a buy-in from clinicians and things too. And we were fortunate that we went into opening this place thinking that way. So there weren't many biases against doing it versus I think other places that are kind of entrenched in something might have a more difficult time because they're more kind of stuck in the we treat one thing type of notion.
No, that makes sense. And I guess so you said there the results have been quite good. Has that been sort of better than you expected or sort of what you had hoped?
So far, they're what we have hoped, and now that we're, you know, as you know, it takes a while to get enough data points together to run the statistics and everything. So, we've hit our 200 patient mark already. So that's really allowed us to start kind of sitting down and taking a look at the stats. But our preliminary results are very, very good. I mean, we're at least at what you would expect from national levels from other service providers and everything in terms of the OCD treatment. And I think that we're doing a little better than you would expect on the substance abuse side. And I think that that's because we've added that mental health component to part of that treatment as well.
No, awesome. And Actually, I want to go back to something you said there about, people have masked sort of uncomfortable and unpleasant emotions or thoughts for some time. Are there any particular strategies or things you'd say to someone who's maybe avoiding those feelings that they just don't want to feel?
Well, I mean, of course, that's what we're always trying to do with exposure therapy, right? I mean, just allowing somebody to do it. And we might even just write the word, you know, and that might be the way that we start. We're not asking you to feel the feeling, but you maybe just stare at the word of the feeling on the board and allow yourself just to sit in a room where that word is sitting on the board. That's been amazingly uncomfortable for some people just starting it that way. So I always still try to start with the lowest level that we can just to get somebody in, because I really want that buy-in from somebody. I'm not here to scare somebody away, and I want them to see that we're really working as a team together with some of these things as well too. So that's my whole goal in doing it.
Yeah. Okay, great. And I guess general question here around substance use and OCD is, what would you tell someone who, let's say they came to you at the ICDF conference and they said they're having issues with substance use and they also have OCD? I guess what kind of advice would you give them? I know it's very general, but
sure. Well, I would say that, you know, find yourself a specialist, and maybe in your area you might only have a specialist for OCD or a specialist for substance use. Work with them to help them find a specialist as well too in the other area. And maybe you don't have the time or the money to see both, but you ought to at least have some consultations going on between the two. And, you know, I have it fortunate enough that we have a whole team here that I can just consult on when someone comes in who is using a certain substance to say, okay, what's the best option here? You know, and we can decide what kind of tracking we're doing with the patient. You know, will they be doing OCD treatment a couple of days a week and substance abuse a few days a week? Will they be doing half days here or there? You know, we can kind of play around with that. But I think for people who are in other areas who don't have that, it really does become essential for therapists to know a good substance abuse provider, and probably for substance abuse providers to know a good anxiety disorder therapist as well, too, just to get that consultation going. Even for therapists to get a consultation group going, maybe in their area, where they can sit down and kind of discuss these types of cases and take a look at what are their options, because they might be some of the only providers in the area, and instead of just saying no to somebody, they're going to have to figure something out. So how can they work together? Another way, of course, is the Behavior Therapy Training Institute does great training for people, so if therapists want to learn more and come into the conference like we were at, and just what a great experience that was for us too. So
absolutely, yeah. No, I think that's a great bit of advice from any therapist listening. Of yeah, sometimes you have to get creative if you're in an area where you are almost isolated as a treatment provider.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So I noticed on the Foglia Foundation website that you guys also use mindfulness. And I was just curious how that gets brought into either substance use or OCD.
Well, we do a mindfulness group every evening, and we really do take a look at the use of mindfulness, not as what a lot of people kind of think of it as the meditation realm, but we look at it as it ought to be a pretty uncomfortable experience, because you are learning to sit with your thoughts, you know? So it kind of comes back to that theme that you were talking about earlier. Our whole goal is to sit with a thought and not try to make something go away or leave it. So to us, it's a very nice incorporation into the theme of what we're going to do for the day, and then a good exercise at night before people go to bed of, you know, you may be going to bed tonight, and at night might be when you put your head down on the pillow and suddenly those thoughts start running through your head and you try to make them go away, and that's why you don't sleep or anything. So what if we, again, through this mindfulness exercise, taught you on your own so that you don't need a therapist sitting there with you, you can sit with a thought and you don't need to make it go away, and it can eventually pass on its own without needing to do something to make that happen.
Excellent. So in the evening group, is that kind of the therapist there is sitting there and almost saying, this is going to be uncomfortable, and almost setting that up instead of making it all pleasant, it's saying this is actually going to be a tough experience, but.
Yeah. And people are learning that, you know, this will be tough, but it's going to be rewarding if you really do practice it.
Yeah. Excellent. Very stoic. I like it. Okay. So when someone leaves the clinic, you know, in the case of that they've had both OCD and substance use, I guess what is the key thing that, I don't know, you'd either tell them or, you would train them up to be aware of this, that I guess lowers their chances of taking substance again? Or yeah, I guess I'll leave it at that.
Sure. One thing that I think is really interesting that we have here is we have a virtual reality program. So I can bring somebody who, let's say, is an excessive drinker into our VR, and I can put them into a scenario where they're at a party and people are offering them drinks, and I'm blowing the smell of the drinks at them as they're seeing the drinks and everything. And what it's really done is it's told people, man, I'm going to have some cravings when I get out of here, aren't I? And it's like, yeah, yeah, you are. And you're going to have to be able to sit with and deal with those things and know that they're going to happen. And it doesn't mean that you're a failure in treatment if you have cravings. It's a reality. You're just going to have cravings and they're going to be there. So why not prepare for those now? You know, I think, again, with substance abuse, sometimes we've maybe taken the tact of you should never be around alcohol or a substance and never be around anybody who does any of those things. But what if you're at a restaurant and someone at the table next to you is checking their blood sugar? Well, that needle could be very triggering for you and cause a craving. Or somebody at a restaurant opens a very nice bottle of red wine next to you and you just get that lovely bouquet of red wine in the air that floats over to your table. Are we going to tell you you have to leave the restaurant or you can't go to family parties because Uncle Joe likes to bring a bottle every year? What if we were to say, hey, we're going to put you in this type of situation virtually. We're going to teach you that you are going to have cravings so that you know that you can handle those. And I'd rather have you experience those cravings now and learn that you can deal with them instead of it being at the party or the restaurant where you might have a chance to actually give in to it.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. So that's kind of, you're going through that experience now where they're in a safe environment being in the clinic. And then when they get those urges, you can work with it, deal with it. And then they have that learning. So when they go out into real life, they can they have that reference point to say, I've resisted once, I can do it again. Whereas I suppose if you haven't done that and they go out, they don't have that reference point to say, I can resist this.
Right, right.
Yeah, no,
that's what we want. We want them to know that they can resist. Yeah. And that, again, they're not a bad person for having a craving.
No. Absolutely. Okay, good. No, that's brilliant. Is there anything else before we kind of move on around sort of addiction that I haven't touched on?
I would just say, too, it's been a rewarding experience for me personally to really get to work with people with addictions who, again, who say to me, wow, no one's ever talked to me about mental health before. And just how I've thought, too, about my own work as a clinician and how I'm sure not purposely by any means, but I'm sure that I missed people who are abusing substances because of not asking the right questions. So again, for clinicians who are listening, we always, Stacey Conroy and I, who through the OCD Foundation have started up the substance abuse like special interest group, we always talk about all clinicians should just basically ask anybody who walks in their office, do you ever take something more than you thought that you should, or people have ever said to you that you shouldn't be taking that much? Have you ever abused something you were prescribed and took more than you were told to take or anything like that? And just a few very basic questions like that are just good things to kind of put into our interviews that we're doing with anyone so that we're not missing out on if somebody might actually be abusing a substance.
Yeah, really good point, because some people may not feel they have a problem. I've definitely seen that in my own personal life, not for me, but a friend of mine who for many years didn't think he had a drink problem. He eventually came to the point where he felt he did, and now he's doing a lot better. But for years, he was oblivious to it.
Mm-hmm.
So we
need to ask those questions. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really good point. And this is more my own curiosity. With addiction, how many... percentage-wise, I don't know if there's any research on this or from your own experience, do you feel that just general mental health or trauma in childhood or anything has caused the addiction as opposed to took a substance once, got hooked, and everything else was fine in my life? Does that make sense?
I think it's just in what I've seen here, upward of 50%.
Wow. So. Yes, pretty high. Okay. Yep. Okay, excellent. And... So what's important, and so general sort of ERP question now for people with OCD.
Sure.
What's important for them to know before starting ERP?
Well, that it's okay to be uncomfortable. I mean, that's the message that I tend to send to everybody, is that your OCD is an interesting thing, because OCD, and I often talk about OCD being almost like a separate entity or something like that, but your OCD thinks it's helpful, because your OCD says to you all the time, hey, this could be bothersome, so make sure you don't think about this. But of course, when OCD tells you not to think about something, you think about it.
Yeah.
And then OCD does this weird thing. It punishes you for thinking about it, even though it was the cause of you thinking about it in the first place. So, you know, and it's just kind of this roundabout kind of thing that goes on, right?
Yeah.
So what if we were to teach people, you know what, it is okay to think about that, actually. And you never have to like it, and it never has to be comfortable, but you can actually think of it, and it doesn't mean you're a bad person or there's something wrong with you or anything like that. And then you inevitably get the people who say, well, why can't I have any other kind of OCD but this kind? You know, why do I think about these really what I think are gross or disgusting kind of intrusive thoughts? And my standard reply to those people is, because those would be the things that would bother you the most. I mean, nobody has OCD about things that don't bother them, right? that would make no sense. You know, it's like, you know, if I'm dirty all the time, but I keep having intrusive thoughts about cleanliness, but I don't care about being clean, well, then it just doesn't bother me, and then it's not going to do anything. So OCD is kind of like a computer virus that searches your brain to what you're most vulnerable to and what you would be the worst thing in the world. And then it says, okay, well, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Yeah, really, really good way of putting it. And I've noticed a lot of kind of blogs coming up, and various people have mentioned it to me around I guess the debate whether how people kind of personify and label their OCD. So some people call it a bully, other people mm-hmm. say it's just trying to help them. Kind of like you've just said, it's kind of just an overactive part of the brain. It actually thinks it's being helpful. Is there any preference to how people could look at it, or is it really just down to the individual whether they want to see it as kind of an enemy that they need to attack, or whether it's just a overactive part of the brain that's trying to help?
Yeah, I've seen it very individualized. You know, some people come in with a name for their OCD already, and, you know, if that's what they have and it works for them, then we call it that name. And other people are just so ashamed about it that they just like to hear the fact that they're talking to somebody who, you know, knows about it, wrote a book on it, and can say to them, hey, look, here's an OCD International Foundation website, and they've even got information on it too. And look, there's a paper here about the kind that you have, and just for them to learn that they're not alone has just been an amazing thing too. So I'll take what I can get, and I'll do it the way that seems to work for them.
Excellent. And a similar question then to the one I asked before is, what's important for them to know during ERP? So let's say they're like six session in. Is it the same as it's okay to be uncomfortable? Is there anything you notice that people sort of halfway or the start, semi-start of treatment?
I do like to warn people that there may come a point as you're moving up your hierarchy that you'll think, well, today I'll just go ahead and do that thing that I used to do, but then that'll be fine. I won't do it tomorrow. And, you know, I kind of liken it to, you would not tell that to someone with an addiction. You would not say, well, I've been off heroin for 3 weeks now, so today I'm going to have some heroin because I've been off heroin for 3 weeks. You know, everyone looks at that and says, well, that's a horrible idea. And we have to think about compulsions in a very similar kind of way. If you've gone for weeks without doing a compulsion, then doing it today is an equally horrible idea.
Yeah, no, I really like that idea, and I think that's an important distinction. And I've definitely been there. I just check once because it's okay.
Yeah,
it's a slippery slope. There was this, and I said this to someone actually at the last conference before Washington, and I read this story about this woman who she lived with like a massive snake. I can't remember what breed it was. Anyway, it was like 6-7 foot long. And it started to go quite erect in the bed over several nights. It would just be, you know, vertical next to her. And she took it to the vet thinking someone was up. And the vet said to the lady, it's sizing you up because it wants to eat you. and I said that it's similar to OCD thoughts. Like when you get them down or compulsions, you feel doing one or two is okay. But it's similar to that. Let's say it's a python. That it looks innocent because it's your pet, but you don't know, it could be sizing you up to eat you, and it's that slippery slope.
Yeah. Well, I hope she got rid of the snake at that point.
I can't remember if I stopped reading or just forgotten the ending, but I think she was okay in the end.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, sleeping with a 7-foot snake is probably a mistake from the get-go. Each to their own. Okay, mm-hmm. So what are some of the things you notice in your clients who recover considerably quicker than, say, other people?
Family support's a big help, and you know, we put a lot of effort into getting some good family help here at the residential. Every Saturday, in fact, is OCD and anxiety family day, so anybody who's on the anxiety side can have family members come and join some of the groups that we do, so they can actually sit in on the education piece and learn from the therapists here about what we're doing. And then we have a support group for the family, kind of like an open forum type of thing, and then they can go ahead and have their visitation. So family support's a big piece of it. If you're working with kids, you have to tell the parents about the exposure therapy and the rationale, because otherwise parents are just going to assume that we're torturing their children and call our bosses. And that happened to me once. I had a student who had told me that, oh, yeah, I told the parents all about why we're doing what we're doing, and then turned out that they actually hadn't, and they were just trying to appease me, and but had actually forgotten. That the next day, of course, I get this screaming father calling me about, you're torturing my child and all these things. Well, I called the student in my office and said, you didn't actually tell them. She said, no, I was going to do it today. I'm sorry. But, okay. So, that rationale is a good thing. And I think if we establish a good rationale with anybody for why we're going to be doing exposures and what our goal is coming out of treatment, that we can really establish a really good treatment relationship in that situation.
Yeah, excellent. And that's when the families come in, do you think the main benefit is sort of the psychoeducation for them? Like, A, they understand how to help exposures, B, they kind of know not to reassure and things like that, or enable.
Yep.
Is that the kind of thing that really helps it when they go back into their homes?
Oh, huge, huge. I mean, the amount of people who, after those first meeting or two, who look at me and say, I've been doing everything wrong for all these years. And I say to them, don't take it personally, but you were doing what you thought was going to be best. And it turned out to be, unfortunately, what OCD wanted and not was going to be best for your spouse or child or something like that. So if you truly want to help your child, you need to stop giving them reassurance.
Yeah.
You know, we also have to teach family members that it is okay if the person with OCD is uncomfortable, because their whole goal is also to stop uncomfortable experiences, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the family wants. The family wants their family member to be uncomfortable. And sometimes I will say to families who are keep giving in to reassurance, I will say to them, if your child was on a detox unit and they were going through withdrawals and they were, you know, throwing up and had diarrhea and they were sweating and it was just the whole most horrible experience for them, and you went to visit them and they said, please just sneak a pint of alcohol in so that I could have some, so I could stop this, would you do it? And they all say, well, no, I would never do that. And I say to them, so here's the issue. Why is it okay for then your child to be physically uncomfortable now in order to be okay later, but you don't accept the fact that it's also okay for them to be emotionally uncomfortable now in order to be better later?
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. And do you find you have to do those kind of comparisons, or is it analogy or metaphor, to something else to kind of really hit home? Is that more impactful than just telling them?
Yes, absolutely. It's so much more impactful, because when I say it that way, they go, oh, yeah, okay, I see it now. Mm. Because they're so stuck in the weeds, they can't see outside of it. Because they'll say, well, you don't know. I mean, are the paint's peeling off our bathroom. If I don't go in and tell them that they're clean, then they're going to just run the shower. And it's like, yeah, you know, I get that. And I realize that as we start to do this therapy, things might get worse before they get better, because we're going to stop all the safety seeking behaviors. And that can be a really difficult adjustment, but it's the process of how we get better. And if you're not willing to do that process, then today's about the best everybody's going to feel in the family, because tomorrow's going to be a little worse than today. And the next day is going to be a little worse than that day. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I like that. Okay, so next question. So you've kind of answered it around it's okay to be uncomfortable, but I'll ask it anyway. Is I guess, what are some of the practical ways people can increase their tolerance of uncertainty?
Well, this again can be where the whole family can be involved in. Everybody does the exposures together. So I have had all families touch things and not wash their hands instead of just say the person, or wish for something to happen to someone. I even show them that I'm willing to do it as well too. So if anyone sees me at the OCD conference, one of the things I'm kind of known for is I have a card in my wallet that says, "I hope my parents die tonight, please God." And there's a 666 on it as well too. And I've carried that card in my wallet for over 15 years now, and people will come up and say, "Do you still have a card on you?" And I'll pull it out and I'll show them. And I do that to prove a point to people that I'm never going to ask you to do something that I'm not going to do as well too. So, and sometimes that hooks people and says, if this guy's willing to do something that uncomfortable, then maybe I'll trust him enough to help me do something uncomfortable too.
Yeah. No, I like it. Is that card laminated?
No, it's getting kind of flimsy, actually. I might have to laminate it, I think. I'll have to visit a library and do a lamination on it soon.
Okay, excellent. So I guess, has your view changed of how you treat OCD in the last few years? Has there any aspects changed?
You know, the view for me that's changed more than anything is just exposure, and response prevention. I have done less talking and more doing with people as I've gotten older and into this a little bit more, just because I found that that's where I kind of see the greatest benefits for people. So,
okay, now that's interesting. And I suppose the more talking, the more risk you run of playing into the OCD.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So some sort of general questions now is, if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell that young man?
What would I tell that young man? Wow. There are so many ways to go with that. in terms of the field, I think what I would say is, don't get frustrated. For anybody who's new in this field and is wanting to do this and has their goals on it, you know, keep pushing for it. I often tell our patients, especially for patients who have maybe had failures or depressed, I tell them kind of my story of getting into the field, which was, in reality, I am a massive failure in psychology. If you look at me by the numbers, when I finished college, I applied to graduate school and I was rejected from 17 schools right off the bat. Just didn't even get an interview. So then I applied to a bunch of master's level programs and I got into three of those. And then I applied to PhD programs again and I got acceptances to two, but still was rejected by 15. And then I applied to 15 internships and I got one offer. And then I applied to 40 jobs and postdocs and I got one offer, one interview actually. And that was the St. Louis Behavioral Medicine Institute. And then now I'm known as, you know, an expert in the field. So, if you look at my applications, there are 96 applications and I have 7 acceptances. So by the numbers, I suck and I'm just one of the worst people in the world. But just because of that doesn't mean that I'm not doing a good job, you know, and that I can't be helpful to somebody. So and I just remember feeling very frustrated back at that age about I was applying to grad schools and looking this and things were going the way that I wanted it to. I think in the end, things turned out pretty well. So.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. And I can see why that's useful for your patients and clients, because definitely with ERP, you can feel like it's hopeless sometimes. And it's a matter of, if you keep putting one foot in front of the other, success is inevitable. It just, you don't know how long it's going to take. That's the question.
Absolutely. In fact, it was funny. I was, we moved into a new house recently and was going through a bunch of old stuff, and I still have all my rejection letters, and I was just kind of paging through it. One of them is from a friend of mine, Charlie Brady, who's the vice president of OCD Midwest. And I took a picture of him and I sent him a very expletive written text going, "You piece of what's a what? You rejected me years ago." So now we have a good time with that one whenever we see each other.
Does he remember why he rejected you, or was it?
No, he said, although you're better off having not gone where I was working at the time, because he eventually left there too. So he said, you're better off that you didn't get the job.
Yeah, you sound like he did you a favor.
Maybe.
Okay, mm-hmm. So similar to a question I asked before, but let's say you're in an elevator going up a few stories and someone knows who you are and they ask for your advice around OCD, and what do you tell them?
I would tell them that, again, it's okay to be uncomfortable. I mean, that is the theme of the things that I tell people all the time, that it is okay to be uncomfortable. And I would also say to them, if you decide to see me as your therapist, I have one goal for you, which is I hope to never see you again for the rest of your life. I want you to learn what you need to learn and then not need me anymore. And that's what I hope for.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. No, I love that. Yeah. You don't want to, I mean, it's different in kind of talking therapies, but with exposure therapy, you don't want to see him again.
No.
Okay. So, lost my questions. So you've got a billboard. Are you based in Chicago?
We're outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm.
So let's say you got a billboard just outside Chicago. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
I think that I would want everyone to see that OCD is treatable, and OCD can be a family problem, and there is help for the entire family system to deal with your family member who has OCD, and we can be the people that can teach you how to do that.
Mm, excellent. And is there anything else that you wish you could have said that I haven't asked you?
One other thing that I just kind of do, and very often the talk that I do at the OCD Foundation is to just get people to recognize the other theme that I like is don't try harder, but try different. Do something else instead of what you're doing. Because if what you were doing really worked, you wouldn't need therapy, right? I mean, and OCD keeps telling you to do the same thing over and over again. So here's the kind of conundrum. If you keep doing that thing over and over again, then why would you ever need therapy if it's actually working? Yeah. And maybe it's time to do something different than what you're doing, because what you're doing isn't actually working. It might work in the short term, but we're here to take a look at what's going to be best for you in the long term, not in the short term.
Mm. Yeah, really good point. I think that's a key distinction, because OCD, in a way, does work. But or doing the compulsions does work, but like as you said, it works only in the short term, and long term it doesn't. It's about, I guess, zooming out and seeing the forest instead of the tree in front of you.
Yeah. I would argue with my grandparents sometimes. They would buy, let's say, a cheap toaster, and I would buy an expensive one, and theirs would break, and then they'd go out and buy another one, and then they'd break and go out and buy another one. So while they were looking at me like, why would you spend all that money on something? In the end, I spent less money and less time and energy on that toaster than they did on the cheap toasters they bought. Yeah. And it's that kind of process of, maybe in the short term this feels a lot better, but boy, it's not working for me in the long run, and I have to think about the long term, not the short term.
Yeah, no, really good point. And I mean, I'm guilty of buying the cheap toasters and irons and stuff. and it is a pain in the ass when they break all the time. I still haven't learned, but I'm sure I will. it's those cheap prices keep hooking me in.
There you go.
Okay, so no, thank you for obviously giving up your time today. I've learned a lot, and I know my listeners, both people with OCD and therapists, will find this useful. So thank you.
No problem. It was great to be here, and happy to come back anytime if you ever want to chat again.
Absolutely.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Patrick. Quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. All the show notes and stuff discussed will be at theocdstories.com/podcast. Until we speak, take care, guys.